Tonight we will look at some of the forces that determine the roles that women have in our society. I have divided these forces into two major areas. The first area consists of obvious, external, sociological forces that limit the roles that women do have in our society. The second area consists of subtle internal psychological factors that operate to determine how a woman thinks of herself and therefore what she will do with her life. I find it too narrow to look at only one area without considering the other and how the two interact in determining the roles of women in our society. Turning first to the more external and obvious limits placed on the role of women. The first factor concerns outright job discrimination against women. That this does exist in Canada has been documented many different times. The most recent and best source of information being the Royal Commission report on the status of women in Canada. Women consistently have lower salaries, as was pointed out by Anne Petrie in the first lecture of this series. In addition, women have worse jobs. What do I mean by a worse job? Income is one, but not the only variable in defining how desirable a job is. In a recent study of office workers in British Columbia, Pat Marchak, who is in the UBC Sociology Department, used the concept of job control in looking at different office jobs. Job control is very much what it sounds like. How much freedom does a person have to determine what his or her job will consist of? 8 different aspects of job control were considered. These 8 areas included, first, content, that is, how much choice does a person have over what is to be included in his or her job? Second, sequence, or how much choice a person has over the order in which a job is to be done. Third, pace, or how much the person is free to decide at what rate the job will be done. Fourth, supervision, that is, how free of external supervision the person is. Fifth, quantity, or the extent to which one has control over the amount of work which he or she will do. Sixth, quality, or the extent to which one can be his or her own judge of the quality of their work. Seventh, time, or the choice one has over when he or she comes to work and leaves work. And finally, space, or the extent to which one is free to move physically in the job. In every single area of job control, significantly fewer women, union and non-union, had jobs with high job control. It has been claimed that women are given less responsible jobs being those with high job control, because they have higher turnover rates, are less committed to their jobs, tend to be less involved in their jobs, and on and on and on. Considering this sample of office workers in BC, these allocations were true. However, they are only true because a greater percentage of women have jobs with low job control. It is people, both men and women, who have low job control jobs that have high turnover rates, are less satisfied with their jobs, and are in general less committed to their jobs. If you consider men and women with high job control jobs, there are no sex differences. Both are equally and highly committed to their jobs. Thus, by keeping women in low-paying, low job control jobs, society keeps on reinforcing its own views that women care less about their jobs, and that it is therefore all right to keep them in the worst jobs, and thus the vicious circle continues. It is an interesting and relevant finding of this study also that it was women with low job control jobs that were most likely to say they would be willing to join a union. Men with low job control jobs expressed much less interest in joining a union. The second major obvious determinant of the roles of women is the care of small children. Society has placed the major burden for the care of children, particularly when they are small, on the woman. Because it is her duty, very few alternative care facilities are available. And if a woman should choose some of these facilities, then she is made to feel guilty because she is not devoting all of her time to caring for her children. what actually does happen to children whose mothers work. The research in this area was mainly done 10 to 15 years ago. It is always interesting to me to look at the personal motivations for any research. Research is not done in a personal vacuum, although many social scientists would like you to believe it is. I believe that much of the motivation behind the research on the effects of a mother's employment outside the home was to show that the effect was negative. That is, that working mothers had maladjusted children. Thus, it was indeed surprising to the researchers to find, in study after study, that there was no difference between children of working mothers and children of mothers who stayed at home. Why should there be no difference? I would say that it is indeed quite a simplistic idea to believe that whether a mother works outside the home or not should have such a powerful effect on children. Why does she work? Is it because of economic necessity or because she wants to? How old are her children? Are they male or female? What is the family social class? All of these questions reflect important variables that are lost if one looks only at whether the mother works outside the home or not. Turning first to the age of the child and the effects of the mother's employment outside the home, it has been assumed that the younger the child, the greater the effect of the mother working. However, of all the many studies of preschool children, there appear to be no observable effects of the mother's employment either at that time or when the child is older. In addition, it does not seem to make any difference whether the mother works from the time the child is very young or whether she waits until the child is 3 or 4 to start work. Despite the fact that there is no overall difference in preschool children of working and non-working mothers, there is one interesting finding concerning the mother's attitudes and behaviors that I feel is very significant of what our society does to the self-image of women. It seems that mothers of young children who do work outside the home, especially if these mothers are working because they enjoy it and not because they have to for economic necessity, feel guilty because they work and therefore tend to overprotect their children. It is not that these children are neglected, as many early researchers thought they would be, but just the opposite. They seem to get too much attention. Why do these mothers feel guilty? They are not doing an objectively worse job with their children. But they are doing what society tells them they should not, that is, leaving their children in the care of someone else for part of the day. While they are not actually depriving their children, they feel that they are, and therefore attempt to make up for this by being a supermother while they're at home. It is interesting that one study found that children of mothers who work because they enjoy it help less around with household chores than do children of mothers who remain at home or children of mothers who work because they have to, that is, mothers who do not like their work. Another important factor in determining the effect of maternal employment on the child is the sex of the child. Several studies have looked at differential effects according to the sex of the child. In general, there do seem to be differences in the effects of the mother's working on boys and girls. These differences are small but consistent. Boys of working mothers are in general more dependent, obedient, and less self-reliant than boys of non-working mothers, while girls of working mothers are in general more aggressive, dominant, disobedient, and independent than girls of non-working mothers. It seems that both boys and girls of mothers who work outside the home are less sex role stereotyped than their peers whose mothers stay home. This may be because of the attitudes of the women who work outside the home. Perhaps mothers who are employed outside the home do not feel that it is so necessary to raise girls that are feminine or boys that are masculine in the traditional sense of the word. One extremely important aspect of maternal employment has in general been ignored by most studies, and this is the attitudes and feelings of the mother toward her work. One study set out to specifically investigate this factor. 4 groups of mothers were compared. The first, mothers working outside the home who preferred this situation. Second, mothers working outside the home who preferred not to be working. Third, mothers not working outside the home who preferred it that way. And fourth, mothers not working outside the home who would have preferred to be working, have some kind of outside employment. All of the mothers were interviewed and answered questions relating to their relationships with their children. From these answers, psychologists rated the mothers on a good mothering scale. Many of the comparisons were not significant, but there were predominantly more dissatisfied, non-working mothers at the lower end of the scale than any of the other three groups, which were spread equally throughout the scale. What strikes me about all of these studies is that we are not asking the right questions. Assumptions are made about working or non-working mothers and what effect this will have on children. Assumptions are made about what good mothering is, as if a good mother is someone who could be good with all children at all ages. It may be that a person who is excellent with small infants may respond less well to the demands of a two-year-old, or a person who is extremely sensitive to the problems and experiences of adolescents may be less sensitive to the dependency needs of the four-year-old. What makes a good mother, or more appropriately, a good caretaker? There is currently one ongoing study which I feel is beginning to ask the right questions and look at the right things. Mothers who had raised very competent children, as judged by teachers, peers, and other people in the community, and mothers who had raised very incompetent but not abnormal children, are being compared in the way they raised their next child. Observations of the mother-child interaction in the natural home environment are being recorded over a long period of time between the time when the child is 1 and 3 years old. Unfortunately, as with most child-rearing studies, the observations do not include the weekend, and thus much father-child interaction is missed. The results that are emerging, however, are most interesting. First, there are both middle-class and lower-class mothers who are doing a fine job of rearing their children, and both middle-class and lower-class mothers who are doing a poor job. Some welfare mothers are included in the sample of excellent mothers, and some mothers who are single parents are also included in the sample of excellent mothers. The group of excellent mothers do not spend all that much time with their children. Some of them have jobs outside the home. Even the mothers who stay home most of the day spend, on the average, less than 10% of their time in direct interaction with the children. What the excellent mothers do with children between 1 and 3, which seems to be important, is to respond immediately and with interest to something the child is excited about and comes to them with. They do not always respond to the child's interest. When they are too busy, they say so. But if the child is genuinely interested in something, they do try to share that interest immediately. Often these interactions may last 30 seconds or less. What seems to be important is not the quantity of time that the mother spends with the child, but the quality of the time she does spend with him or her. Even more important, perhaps, is the picture that emerges of the mothers in the C group, the mothers who seem to be doing a poor job. They do not appear to be the evil, uncaring, grotesque people that psychologists have made them out to be. In fact, they appear to love and care for their children and to be very involved in mothering. What seems to be happening is that they are people who do not seem to be able to cope with and respond appropriately to the 1 to 3 year old child, who is, to say the least, a most difficult human being to live with. It is probably one of the greatest injustices done to women to assume that they all should be capable of living with, caring for, and maximizing the development of small children. I would like to consider briefly one further area relating to the care of small children. This is the issue of daycare. There is too little research on daycare, particularly on different qualities of daycare. As with the working versus non-working mothers, there are no consistent differences found between children in daycare and children at home. I would hypothesize, however, That even with large amounts of information available, we are not going to be able to find that daycare is either good or bad for children in general. Children in good daycare may have certain advantages and certain disadvantages over children in good homes. For example, and I'm speculating here, it may be that while children in good daycare may be slightly disadvantaged with respect to language development, they may be slightly advantaged with respect to social development. It will probably not come down to whether daycare is good or bad for children, but whether it is good or bad with respect to certain goals of development. Once a goal is determined, research can help explain how that goal can be reached. But goals cannot come from science. They must come from the parents and the society. I think this is well illustrated by the overall results of the kibbutz experiment. In general, kibbutz children are quite healthy and well adjusted, even though there is a very small amount of time spent in adult-child interaction and much greater proportion of time in child-child interaction. What seems to be different is that these children grow up to be less individualistic than Western children and are much more concerned with the welfare and opinions of the social group. This is a difference in goals, however, rather than a difference in mental health, adjustment, or maturity. In Western society, we value individualism highly and see anything that limits it as bad. The kibbutz has, however, an avowed goal of rearing children with a strong tie to the group and to the society. In conclusion, the discrimination against women in the labor force and the responsibilities of rearing small children are very real limitations which determine the roles of women. However, there is an advantage in that these are relatively obvious limits. A large portion of the Status of Women report deals with the areas of women in the labor force and with the responsibilities for care of small children. While these problems cannot begin to be cleared up immediately, at least it is fairly easy to see where to begin by providing job opportunities and money for alternate forms of childcare. What I would like to turn to next presents a much more subtle, and I would argue therefore more severe, barrier to the equal participation of women with men in the present or any future society. That is, how it is that women are taught to think of themselves. While the elimination of job discrimination will do much to change this, it cannot do everything, since how one thinks of oneself, that is, one's self-image, is determined by many different variables throughout life. Some of these variables are listed on the single page, the blue one that was handed to you when you came in the door. And I drew this up, or I copied this from another source that I had found, largely because I hope it may help you think about your own personal experiences and what sort of got you to where you are in terms of sexual development and sex identity. I will argue in the next few minutes that women form their self-image from what others think of them, and that they fear the consequences of their own success as well as their own failure, and that they, as well as men, assume that anything a woman does is, by virtue of this, less worthy and useful than what a man does. Turning first to the development of the sources of self-esteem, girls and women, I would argue, form their main images of themselves from what others think of them. In early development, boys are forced to give up the natural dependency behaviors of infancy, because it is not masculine, and therefore they are much more likely than girls to become alienated from their parents and to turn inward for definitions and beginning ideas about who they are. In addition to being forced quite early to be independent of others, boys are encouraged by a relatively unrestricted environment to explore themselves in many different activities. Girls, being much more likely to be accepted for who they are rather than what they do, are allowed to continue in early infancy dependency behaviors longer than boys. In addition, they are somewhat more restricted in the ways they may choose to explore themselves. In early development, however, in a way, girls seem to be less pressured. They learn that others will accept them for who they are, and they do not have to prove themselves worthy of this acceptance. They may try many things, and doing well will please other important people, especially parents. But it is not necessary in order to earn the respect and the love of these people. By contrast, the world of the boy seems much harsher, as he will have to do well in addition to just being in order to be accepted. However, through this testing and proving himself, the boy learns what things he is good at and what things he cannot do, and begins to see these as very important parts of himself. In adolescence, this previous experience with who he is helps the boy in his experience with sudden physical and psychological changes. The girl, however, while having an easier time of it in early childhood, in adolescence is faced with a sudden and quite dramatic physical change with the onset of menstruation. These changes have tremendous psychological implications, and the girl is faced seriously with the question of who am I? But in answering this question, she gets very little help. Just when she is beginning to ask these questions seriously, society begins to tell her that her real measure of success is in how other people see her, especially males. How many dates does she have? How pretty is she? How acceptable will she be when she gets ready to marry? In other words, just at the time that she should be concentrating on internal feelings and problems, she is told to concentrate on her external appearance and acceptability socially. Thus, negative feelings and reactions are strongly discouraged. One must be pleasant and agreeable, just at the time of life when this is least likely to be natural. Thus, a girl is now actively encouraged to think of herself in terms of what others think about her, especially important males in her life. And if she marries, her sense of self-esteem now comes largely from her husband and children. Because her sense of self-esteem comes largely from others, the woman continues to be more vulnerable in close relationships. Failure in a close relationship is a serious crisis for any person. But when your sense of self is also tied up in the relationship, the failure is not only a crisis, but also a loss of self. If one is vulnerable in a relationship, then one is much less likely to do anything to threaten that relationship. It seems that one thing that adolescent and young adult women perceive as threatening their relationships with men is success. Thus, it has been hypothesized that women have a fear of success. What an odd concept, you say. That we consider it odd reflects perhaps a very masculine conception of the world. Success is what our society pushes on us constantly, to do well and to get ahead. This is true, and a girl learns this and adopts the values of success to some extent. But a fear of what competitive success might do for her relationship with men puts her in a conflict situation. Recently, Martina Horner, a psychologist interested in achievement motivation, hypothesized that perhaps women were conflicted about success as well as about failure. Success, especially in a situation involving competition with males, might, she argued, be perceived as a threat to one's femininity, since success means beating someone, that someone usually being a male. Thus, in her first study, which is described in some detail in the article you were given for tonight, Horner carried out a study of fear of success with first-year students at a large university in the States. 90 female students were given the story after first-term finals, Anne finds herself at the top of her medical school class. The 88 males in the study were given the story after first-term finals, John finds himself at the top of his medical school class. The subjects were asked to tell a story in reaction to this situation. Basically, this test is a projective one, which means that it is assumed that people will project into the situation feelings of their own. All of the stories were scored for fear of success. This included any stories which reflected negative consequences because of success, expression of conflict about success, denial of the situation, or an attempt to move away from the situation. The differences between the sexes were highly significant, with 65% of the female stories reflecting fear of success, and only 10% of the male stories reflecting fear of success. The stories of the females which reflected fear of success could be divided into three categories. The most frequently occurring category of story was one reflecting fear of social rejection. Here are some examples of stories that represent a fear of social rejection. This is the first story. Anne has a boyfriend, Carl, in the same class, and they are quite serious. Anne met Carl at college, and they started dating about their sophomore year of undergraduate school. Anne is rather upset, and so is Carl. She wants him to be higher scholastically than she is. Anne will deliberately lower her academic standing the next term, while she does all she subtly can to help Carl. His grades come up, and Anne soon drops out of med school. They marry, and he goes on in school while she raises their family. Or the second story, Anne is a wonderful girl who has always succeeded. She never had to work. Anne didn't really care. She went to med school because she couldn't marry. She really cares nothing and wants to get married. No one will marry her. She has lots of friends, but no dates. She's just another girl. She tries to pretend that intelligence is not part of her. She doesn't hide it, she just ignores it. She will get a great job in a marvelous hospital. I don't know if she ever will marry. Another kind of story, which was less frequent, centered around concerns about one's normality or one's femininity because of the success. Here are two examples of these stories. The first one, Anne is completely ecstatic, but at the same time feels guilty. She wishes she could stop studying so hard, but parental and personal pressures drive her. She will finally have a nervous breakdown and quit med school and marry a successful young doctor. The most common solution, by the way, for Anne was to marry a doctor in some form or another. Second story, Anne cannot help but be pleased, yet she is unhappy. She had not wanted to be a doctor. She had half hoped her grades would be too poor to continue, but she had been too proud to let that happen. She had worked extraordinarily hard, and her grades showed it. It is not enough, Anne thinks. I am not happy. She is not sure what she wants, only feels the pressure to achieve something, even if it is something she doesn't want. Anne says, to hell with the whole business, and goes into social work. Not hardly as glamorous, prestigious, or lucrative, but she is happy. The third category, which occurred quite frequently, this was second only to fears of social rejection, were stories in which the girl denied the success of Anne. Many of these stories were remarkably ingenious in the twists that were used to change the original story, which remained in writing in front of the subjects at all times. They also represent how threatening some of the subjects found Anne's successful achievement to be. Examples of these stories include, the first one, Anne is a code name for a non-existent person created by a group of med students. They take turns writing papers and exams for Anne. Or another one, Anne is really happy that she's on top, though Tom is higher than she is. Though that's as it should be. Anne doesn't mind Tom winning. Another, Anne is talking to her counselor. The counselor says she will make a fine nurse. She will continue her med school courses. She will study very hard and find she can and will become a good nurse. And finally, it was luck that Anne came out on top of her med class because she didn't want to go to med school anyway. Several of the girls assumed the role of society and punished Anne for her success. In one story, her classmates jump on her in a body and beat her. She is maimed for life. In an interview situation, girls were asked to describe Anne. More than 70% classified her as unattractive, while 50% classified her as tall. In contrast to the above stories, listen to a typical male story told in the same situation. John is very pleased with himself. He realizes that all his efforts have been rewarded. He has finally made the top of his class. John has worked hard and his long hours of study have paid off. He spent hour after hour in preparation for finals. He is thinking of his girl Cherie, whom he will marry at the end of med school. He realizes he can give her all the things she desires after he becomes established. He will go on in med school making good grades and will be successful in the long run. For the male, it seems, professional success will increase rather than decrease one's chances for social success. Why does fear of success occur? What factors lead to high or low fear of success? In an interesting study, it was found that women in their last year of college, the arousal of fear of success was determined in large part by their male peers. Females scoring high in fear of success were those who either did not date at all, or they dated men who disapproved of women having careers. When asked what their male peers thought, most of these girls responded, "They laugh." Another said, "He thinks it's ridiculous for me to go to graduate school or law school. He says I can be happy as a housewife, and I just need to get a liberal arts education." Or another girl said, "I am turning more and more to the traditional role because of the attitudes of my boyfriend and his roommates. I am concerned about what they think." In contrast, females with low fear of success scores all were engaged to or dating men who actively encouraged and expected them to do well. Some of their statements included, "He wants me to be intelligent. It is a source of pride to him that I do so well." Or, "He thinks it's a good idea for me to go to law school." Perhaps most interesting was that for all the couples where the male encouraged the female's achievement strivings, there was a mutual understanding that he was the smarter of the two. In contrast, in the couples where the females showed high fear of success and the males disapproved of their aspirations, there was a tension which seemed to be rooted in the fear that indeed she was the more intelligent of the two. How does fear of success affect the women's actual attempts to succeed? Horner found that women who were high in fear of success performed intellectual tasks better by themselves than when they were competing with someone else. That is, their fear of success seemed to dampen their performance when they had to compete with someone else. In contrast, women with low fear of success scores do better when competing with someone than when working alone. This latter pattern is typical of male performance. In addition to experimental situations, there is evidence that women in college, especially the most capable women, change their career plans toward careers that are more traditionally feminine and require less preparation, etc. When does fear of success begin? This is hard to answer since there are very few studies with young children. However, Horner found that there were significant increases in fear of success between junior and senior high school, and another significant increase between the first and last years of college. It is interesting that this increase occurred whether the story involves successful competition in a highly masculine field like law or medicine, or whether it involves success in a less masculine endeavor like writing a novel in one's spare time. Another study looking at the development of fear of success was done by Naomi Bardi, who is a psychology student at UBC. She used 10 to 13-year-old boys and girls from Surrey. She used three different situations. The first involved a situation where a boy and girl were competing for first place in their grade 12 class. The children were asked to tell which one would win. In this situation, 56% of the children refused to choose and indicated that the result was a tie. This, I think, indicates how important doing well in school is to children of both sexes at this age. There was among the girls very little evidence of fear of success. Most of them either said the two tied or that Anne won. In several of the individual girls' stories, however, one senses the beginnings of fear of success. Thus, one 11-year-old girl has Anne meeting the typical fate of a successful and proud female. I quote from her story. So she starts to brag to all her friends and makes Bob feel very bad, and everyone is saying, a girl can beat you, ha ha ha. Anne, with a big smile, opens her report. Bob, feeling a little down, opens his. Soon, both expressions change. Bob won higher grades than Anne. If you're too good and female,